Welcome, everybody. It's time once again for the next chapter with Charlie Hedges. As he explores turning the page on his life and yours. Hey, Charlie.
Hey, Paul. Let's start today with this. You could be retired for decades, so you might as well get good at it. Our guest today, Andy Robin, truly loves what he writes. In his recent book, The Tapas Life, Andy articulates fresh ideas about living a delicious life, one with all the tastiness of a tapas meal. And for those of us not familiar with that Spanish idea of tapas, just think of a meal consisting only of several appealing appetizers with no main course. On this show, Andy will share how a life of what he refers to as prototyping versus creating a grand plan, and he then provides generous wisdom in retirement, but also for those smack dab in the center of today's busy and demanding world of work. Andy Robin is a man of deep and provocative wisdom about how to live with full vigor and full vitality. Please enjoy my conversation with Andy Robin as we share a taste of a tapas meal. Andy Robin, welcome to the next chapter with Charlie.
Why, thank you, Charlie. Thanks for including me. Happy to be here.
Good. I'm so glad. You know, Andy, I've been looking forward to our chat today for so many reasons, and none the least of which is the diversity of subjects we can discuss. Obviously, we will get in depth regarding your delicious book, The Tapas Life. And then there are so many other fascinating subjects, like 20 years living in Mexico City as a youth and young adult, your success in technology, half a decade as a house dad, and your intriguing notions of what I'm calling the so-called retired life. And so I think where to begin. So what I've decided, Andy, is let's start with none of the above.
Of course.
Of course. In our pre-discussion, you shared with me former French President Charles de Gaulle's four principles of life. Would you treat us with those principles?
Yes, sure. His first one is always seize the initiative, because if you don't seize the initiative, then you will be part of somebody else's initiative, dancing to their tune. His second one was always exploit the inevitable. Because, you know, if it's inevitable anyway, well, you might as well get in front of it and ride it, right?
Right.
Figure out how you can exploit it. His third one, which I think is most appropriate for a politician, but good for the rest of us, is always stay in with the outs. Because the people who are out now may come back. And if you've been mean to them or not stayed in touch with them, then that will be a problem for you. And of course, the fourth one is the wisest of all, namely, never get caught between the dog and the lamppost.
And you know, you want to
avoid that.
That's metaphorical as well as literal. You certainly don't want to get caught there. And the third one is about the ins and the outs. That's sort of, you know, I have a sort of a divine, sometimes Christian approach to my podcast, and that's sort of Jesus' way of doing things. He focused on the outies and not the innies, and that certainly, it worked for him until they decided to kill him for it. But. So you know what I would like to just talk a bit about the first two axioms of wisdom that I think just can't be ignored, and that is seizing the initiative and exploiting the inevitable. You seem to have led a life that is filled with both of those. Tell me about that, how those interrelate with your life.
Okay, well, I mean, exploiting the inevitable. My dad was an entrepreneur and moved the family from Mexico City to Mexico City from Chicago when I was 7. So I didn't have much choice but to exploit the inevitable there. But as far as seizing the initiative, I guess having grown up in both the U.S. and Mexico, I came to understand that there were different ways to look at things. Because the two countries and their mentalities are pretty different. And so it became clear to me in a broader sense that there are a lot of different lives that one can choose to live on the planet. And for better or for worse, I think for worse, most of what our life is supposed to be like is dictated to us by advertising and popular culture. And so a lot of people are dancing to that tune. And I always like to seize the initiative by saying, well, here's what I'd like my life to be like. It's the concept of be the author of your own life. Yeah, I went off and crafted a life that was the way I wanted it. And I'm not always in sync with everybody else. And I sometimes have been ridiculed or had people ask me how come I'm doing that or whatever. And I sort of don't care because I'm living the life that I want to live. That's how I've gone about it.
You used an important verb that is meaningful in my life and I think for all of us, and you used choosing, that we do have a choice and yet we don't seem to grasp the idea that we have a choice. We sort of feel like life is prescripted and we have to follow this prescription. And what you're suggesting is, no, you don't. That you can prescript your own life, and as we will get into much deeper, especially with your book, the Tapas Life, we will get much deeper into that. But I do like the idea of choosing. That seems important. In as we talked previously, it seems important in your life. Would you agree with that?
Oh, it's super important. The phrase I like is that you are at choice. You can choose. And in my coaching work, oftentimes a client will say, well, I should do this, or I have to do that. And I'll say, actually, that's a choice. And, you know, that causes people to stop and realize that, oh, yeah, I guess that is a choice. In fact, my wife, who, among other things, teaches leadership executive coaching, she loves to do an exercise with a pair of people where she says, you know, one of you tell the other one about a difficult situation you were in and talk all the way through it. And they do that. And then she says, okay, rewind back to the beginning and now do that again, noting all the different places you actually made a choice where you could have done something else, could have chosen differently. And actually, when you do that with somebody, you suddenly realize just how much choice you have all the time.
But unfortunately, too commonly, we don't recognize it's a choice, and we fall into that should-dos, and we don't think the choice is ours, that we have to follow somebody else's instructions or somebody else's ideals or plans, don't we?
Yeah, unfortunately so. And I suppose in a sense, it's the path of least resistance because we don't have to think. But at least in my view of life, wow, that's a lot left on the table.
It is. And I can't wait till we share your banquet table. And I'm just teasing people, letting them know that's going to come later in the podcast. But You offer a delightful and delicious banquet table. I'm going to do a little bit about your life, because you, in our pre-interview, you just fascinated me with so many different things. All right, so let's go back 20 years or so, and you are a stable guy, as you put it, in executive positions in the field of technology. And then when your kids were the ages of 13 and 15, a change of roles occurred in your family life. Talk to me about that.
Exactly right. So if we roll back a few years beyond that, when my wife and I got married, we had at that point spent some months talking about what we wanted our lives to be, individually and together. And one of the things we realized is that although we were both at good places in our career and on the way up, I was a marketing director and she managed sales and marketing for the 13 Western states for an industrial automation company, we both wanted to have our career. We also both wanted to be at-home caregivers. We both like kids, find them fascinating, and wanted to be there for them and with them. And so we talked about different ways we could go about that. And we finally settled on sequential. And so the agreement was my wife would leave her career temporarily so we would have kids. And you know, she could breastfeed them better than I could. And she was a great at-home mom with the little guys and was great at installing morals and ethics and right from wrong in the little guys with my help in the evenings and on the weekends. And the agreement was when they were around 6 or 8 or 7 and 9, we would swap. And what happened is she found a new career. She found she liked interpersonal work. And so she went back, got a master's and PhD in that, and that postponed the swap until the kids were 13 and 15. And so one Friday afternoon, you know, my executives at the company I worked at took me out to lunch and, you know, asked me if I had lost my mind or what it was, that I was going to go home and be a house dad. And I was like, yeah, no, this is what I choose to do. This is what we have planned to do for years. And now we're doing it. And on Saturday morning, my wife left on a 3-week business trip to Australia. And I was instantly house dad. And, you know, at first I knew something, but certainly had a lot to learn.
I'm sure.
I got a few pointers here and there, but had a great time with it.
Some would think it odd, but it finds that you and I view parenting very similarly, and you had some ideas about parenting that were not common for, you know, high school age kids and the sort of role of parenting and strong guidance and direction and getting permission. You had a whole different view. Tell me about that different approach that you used with your children when they were going through early adolescence or mid-adolescence.
Yeah, sure, Charlie. The fact is that my wife had a little bit more control over our kids, maybe a little bit shorter leash. And when I took over, I saw the kids as they had become. I thought they were pretty smart and reasonably responsible. Yeah, I did crazy stuff that teenagers all do. Certainly nothing anywhere near as the crazy stuff I did as a teenager. And so I looked at him and said, look, I'm not that controlling like mom. And so here's what we're going to do. You know, you kids go to school and try to learn something. And I know sometimes it'll be boring and you'll have lousy teachers, but try to learn what you can. I promise it will be in large part useful later in life. And after school, if you come home, grand, I'll give you a snack. If you go somewhere else, tell me where you went. Anytime you move around from place to place, call and let me know where you've gone. And, yeah, do your homework. Be home by 6 so we can eat dinner together. And, you know, have fun. Learn and grow and have fun. Explore. And, you know, you'll have a time you need to be home at night, and it will change depending on how old you are at that time.
How mature you are.
That's the deal.
Yeah.
So I guess I said, I'm trusting you to be reasonably mature. I didn't say in my heart of hearts, I know you're crazy teenagers and not mature, but mature enough. You know, it was years later at dinner one night with the four of us when they were in their 20s, and our son confided that he looked at our daughter, his little sister, and said, hey, this sounds like a pretty good deal. Let's not screw it up.
You know, I think I told you that I had a very similar inspiration when my son, I just have one child. And when my son was about 14, I viewed my role as I was in a transitionary process from 14 to 17 to 18, is that I was transitioning from a parent to a consultant. In that I realized my child was going to be making decisions, whether I liked it or not. My child was going to be making decisions about his life. So I had a choice. I could either give these restrictions and that he must do this and follow me, that he's going to disobey all of them and feel guilty and, you know, sort of disregard me, rather than I viewed, let's chat about this, son. Let's chat about what you have plans, what you're going to do. Let's see what's wisest and what's best, what works and what's not, what doesn't work. And he was, but he was like your children. He was raised with very, very strong boundaries. He knew what was allowed and what wasn't allowed. And yet, you know, when he went away, as a result, you know, he had his chores to do. He did a large, his sports laundry. He did all of his, he was a baseball player, really. He played all sports. But he did his sports laundry, so he knew how to work a washing machine. And when he left high school, he didn't go to college. He went right to athletics. And he moved from California to Indiana. And moving into an apartment with a bunch of guys was an easy transition for him. Or it was easier that he was used to making decisions, used to choosing what to eat, knew how to cook a few meals, knew how to do the dishes, knew how to do the laundry. And it just jump started him into life, rather than, you know, because he didn't go to a college where he was babysat. He had to go into real world and act like an adult at 19 years old. And that was just by luck that we came upon that. But it sounds very similar to the way that you rose, that you raised Molly and Nick. That's what I thought. Molly and Nick. Those are similar, are they not?
They are indeed. We had the good fortune that my wife, when she was the at-home parent, came home one day and said, we're going to go hear this teen consultant speaker over at the middle school. And we did. A guy named David Riera, who's written some books. And that was the key point that stayed with me is, yeah, one day they're not very direct about it, but they don't want you to manage them anymore, and they fire you.
Yeah.
And, yeah, then the object of the game is to get rehired as a consultant.
Yes. Yes.
So it's not, hey, it's time to go to bed. Go to bed. It's, hey, I'm going to bed. You might want to think about it. I notice when you don't get enough sleep, you're kind of crabby and have a tough time. Good night. See you.
Yeah, that is so, that is so, I don't want to say un-American, but it is so not the way we raise children now.
It doesn't seem to be, but think about it, Charlie. The whole point of raising the kids is so that they'll become independent, responsible, ethical, productive citizens.
And I would add problem solvers.
Problem solvers. And you don't do that by keeping them on a tight leash. You give them opportunities to learn how so that they're self-sufficient. Similarly, as you and I talked about in our pre-call, you know, I put each kid on a budget when they got to 10th grade.
You have to tell us about
so
that, because that is brilliant. That is brilliant. Tell, you know, do that kind of briefly for me, but that is really, I think that was brilliant, and I did not do that, and I truly wish that I had.
You know, just briefly, I kind of watched what kind of money they consumed, eating and entertainment and clothing, not shoes or music equipment or sports equipment, but kind of basic stuff. And after some time of watching that, I proposed first to our oldest, okay, we're going to start a budget. And here's how much money I think it should be for the month. It covers these things. And we'll try a practice month, and then you let me know if it seemed about right or we adjust it. And then after that, I said, okay, now it launches. Now this is the real month. And, you know, at the end of the third week of the real month, you know, he came back and said, I'm out of money, Dad. Can I get some of next month's money? And I said, yeah, no, that's not how it works. That's all there is. There ain't no more. I'm happy to make you some bag lunches this week. And then next month's a fresh month. And that was that. We never had that circumstance again because he now understood how a budget works.
Andy,
it was pretty good. And then I did the same with our youngest 2 years later.
How many youth are taught how to budget in everyday life? I mean, it becomes obvious because at 30 and 40 years old, they're still not budgeting. And you gave, what a gift you gave to your children to survive adulthood. That was brilliant. I wish I had done that. It would have gone a long way.
I was in fact really proud of our son because when he was in college in Washington D.C., he was volunteering and teaching personal finances, you know, basic stuff like, you know, a bit of budgeting, a bit of how does a bank account work, have a checkbook at the time with inner city high school kids. And I loved that.
That's tremendous. That's tremendous. Before we get into the book, because I want to spend the second half of our show on the book, I do have a bit of a longer topic, but it's something that I read in one of the various readings that I was reading about you, and that you are an advocate, and this is important for all of us to catch. In life, you are an advocate of prototyping versus creating some kind of grand plan, of prototyping your life rather than the grand plan. We're the grand planners. We are, you know, as you know, you can't help the beginning of the year, the year beginning planning, all the planners jump out. They want our year end, our 5 year, our 10 year plan. And you're talking about prototype. Andy, I think that is brilliant. What do you have in mind when you're talking about prototyping versus a grand plan?
Well, I've done it differently at different times, Charlie. So early in life, coming out of college, I was kind of prototyping. I was trying to figure out where did I fit in life, and so I tried some different things until I found something. And the truth is, after that, I gradually created a grand plan. And I lived it until I became a house dad. And ever since, I went back to prototyping. And so, you know, I didn't invent this. This is, you know, this is design thinking. It's move fast and break things. A lot of people work with this concept these days. But the idea is, especially for me after my long career, you know, most of the things I could do didn't have major consequences, whether they went well or poorly. I mean, I had to do a good job of parenting, but beyond that, I could try things. And if they didn't work out, oh well. You know, I tried to mine the experience for learning.
I love that concept of mine the experience or mine your opportunities. Flesh that out for me, because it's such a quick phrase to pass over, but it is too deep and too meaningful. What do you mean by mine the experiment or mine and that opportunity? Tell me about that.
So as an example, after our youngest went to college and I was done with the main years of parenting, I didn't know what I would do. And I said, well, maybe I want to go, you know, use my business brain. And I knew I didn't want to go back to the kind of stuff I was doing, but maybe something related. And you know, I like the environment, so I thought I'd get something in solar energy. And I, you know, made up a resume and sent it to CEOs of solar energy firms in my area. Yeah, one of them actually responded, and I went in and did some interviewing. And I said I was willing to work half time for a tiny fraction of what I had been making in my long career. And we settled on we would do that for a few months and see how it was for us each. At the end of a few months, I think they decided that they wanted somebody more like a formal consultant who would make pretty reports with graphs and charts. And that's not me. I like to, you know, here's the meat of it. And I decided that half-time work at that point was really invasive on my life. So when I mined that for learning, I was like, yeah, actually, I'm pretty bored with business in general. Even though this was something new and I learned some stuff, it was kind of cool. But the nature of the company and business and, you know, working with people and political situations, I was like good and done with that after a few decades. So I learned that. I learned that if I wanted to do anything, I didn't want to do it half time. That was too big a chunk.
Right.
And that was, in fact, when the, you know, the notion of tapas, of small dishes, like the small dishes of Spain, started to form in my head. And I started to realize that maybe having more small things would be a more interesting life. And with small things, it's easy to prototype. You try it. Ooh, I like it. I'll do more of it. And by the way, here's what I learned. I learned that when I was doing this, that was really nice for these reasons. Oh, I tried it and it was turned out bad. Oh, well, how can I mine that for learning? Oh, it turns out when I'm doing stuff that has politics with other people involved, I'm good and done with that. I'm going to avoid that in the future.
I don't know why, but it reminds me somewhat of attributed to Nelson Mandela, who says it's not about winning and losing, it's about winning and learning. And
oh, I love that.
And I think that has to do with what you're saying there. You also talk about avoiding living on autopilot. That is so much, you know, once we get in a routine or we get into a job, like it or not, you know, I've often said that a bad known is better than any unknown. And so we'll stick into that autopilot bad known because there's no risk. We know what to expect. We don't like what we're going to expect, but there's little fear of it. There's complaint, but little fear. What do you mean by avoiding living on autopilot?
Well, I'll be quite honest. The last 5-6 years of my long career, I chose to be on autopilot. So I was done. I was bored. I asked to change what I was doing inside the companies that I was working at. Everybody said, "Nah, you're a great marketing guy. You got to do that." And, you know, that was back when companies didn't say, take what vacation you want. I had gotten where I accrued 5 weeks of vacation a year. And I really valued that time with my family. And I was really well paid. And they kept, you know, giving me more perks. And so I resolved to be in a situation that was kind of boring for me because I knew it inside out. And that had politics I was bored with and done with. And I stayed in it. I was being kind of a mercenary on behalf of the family. I knew the swap of roles was coming along. So I stuck with it. Now, I wasn't on total autopilot because it didn't just happen. I chose that actively. And since then, since making that swap, no autopilot for me. It's now always a choice. And when stuff starts to be stuff I don't like, I see how can I get that out of my life and install something else better.
Yeah, you talk about not
being...
Go ahead.
I was going to say, when you've got big family responsibilities and you're saving up for college tuitions and towards your retirement, and you know, sometimes you make hard choices to do what you have to do.
So here's what I want to do. It is time to move into the Tapas Life, your brilliant book. But before we do that, we're going to take a brief break. Hang in. It'll just be about 30 seconds, and we'll be right back, okay?
Okay.
Hi there, this is Charlie Hedges, and you're listening to The Next Chapter. My special guest today is author, whole life, full enjoyment life living, Andy Robin, and he has written a new book titled The Tapas Life. Now, Andy, I know you wrote this book with an intention for an audience that's entering or already in retirement. But I have found that the principles that you lay down in that book are principles for life that apply to just about any adult at any age. So if you're not in retirement, please don't turn off the show right now, because what Andy has to offer are really sound suggestions for all of us. And so let me begin, Andy, by saying, what led you to write this book?
After our youngest went to college, you know, I had no grand plan, and I had prototyping sitting there in front of me. And it took me about 4.5 years to assemble the life I wanted. I had no playbook. I had no guidance, and, you know, I read here and there, but didn't really find anything very satisfying.
And pardon me, but that's really essential that people know that it took 4.5 years. It didn't take 4.5 days, 4.5 weeks, 4.5 months. It took 4.5 years. It is what I call patience and the slow work of God. It is just that to be patient that it will become known to you, but never in the timing that you're expecting. So I like that 4.5 years. So please move forward.
Indeed. And, I mean, the 4.5 years culminated when I realized that I had assembled a great hedonic life, but I was really just a consumer of resources and an enjoyer and a learner. But I wasn't doing anything other than, you know, being a dad and husband in my family. I wasn't really doing anything meaningful. Namely, something that benefited someone else selflessly. And it was when I found my meaningful tapa at the end of the 4.5 years that I concluded, okay, now I've got a nice life. Now this is good. And at that point, I started thinking, not immediately, but maybe within the next couple of years after that, I think I'll write about this because this was hard. And there's no really good guidebook for how to do this. So I figured I'd write a step-by-step book for assembling a pretty good life. And a good chunk of the book would be about things to do, things that you needed to do to assemble that good life and to have a life of doing. And a good chunk of the book would be about what you could do in terms of being, how you might augment how you are and make yourself a better person and a fuller person.
Such good questions.
And I figured I'd write the book. It's part of my meaningful tapa. It was to try to be helpful to someone else. I'm certainly not in it for my stinking $2 royalties.
Yeah, I know. Before we get into the steps, I think it's important. I'm not sure all of our audience understands what a tapa is. Can you explain that to me?
Sure. In Spain, and also around the Mediterranean and the Middle East, instead of doing like we Americans, where we have a large porterhouse steak on the plate and maybe some potatoes and a vegetable. Instead of that big main course, they eat lots of little dishes. So you might have a little dish of greens. You might have a little dish of meat. You might have a little dish of some veggie, of some starch. And you know, you start off your meal by ordering a glass of wine and a few little dishes, and then you're still hungry, yeah, another few dishes, and oftentimes you share with others at the table. So there's a bunch of these little dishes covering the tabletop, and you serve yourself onto your own little like salad plate.
You know, my son is a foodie, and he loves fine restaurants. And he has discovered that what instead of tapas in fine restaurants, we call them appetizers. And
yep.
And he and his wife no longer order main courses. They will order a half dozen appetizers because two reasons. One, they want to test everything in the restaurant. And secondly, chefs tend to put more energy and more creativity in their appetizers than they do in their main dishes, because they're creating them all the time, and appetizers are changing. So you can actually get the best food in a restaurant in an appetizer as opposed to a main course. Would you agree?
I love it, and I totally agree. It's just a great way to do it. So whether you call it appetizers or mesas like in Turkey or tapas like in Spain, it's the concept of putting together a lot of these little bites into a fine meal.
So let's get into your principles. You have some steps and principles that are flat brilliant. So let's start with the white rabbit.
Yeah, I have a chapter called White Rabbit in the Snowstorm. And some people are like, what? What? Well, if you think about a big snowstorm coming down hard, there's a white rabbit out there, pretty hard to see. In fact, all you see is a big sheet of white. The object of that chapter is you don't want your calendar to look like that, because you rapidly become untethered and feel adrift. And those are things that lead to depression.
And isn't like that the calendar of a pretty recently retired person? I know I went through a couple years of boredom and uselessness. And because I'd look at my calendar and there was nothing on my calendar, and I was used to a totally filled calendar. And so I viewed it as a reflection on my value.
Yeah, that's a depressing place to get to, and a lot of people go there. It's really important, therefore, to lay in some structure, Charlie. Lay in some things that you're doing each and every week. Whether it's simple things like you're having breakfast and reading email, or the news, or you're doing laundry, or you work out a certain number of times a week, whether it's biking or machines or swimming or whatever it may be, or you're meeting a friend for lunch a couple of times a week to get yourself out of the house, or if you've got a spouse, you decide you'll have a date night yourselves or with another couple. Or maybe you lay in a recreation like bridge or mahjong or something like that.
Crossword puzzles. I have friends that are into crossword puzzles.
Totally. Totally. But you put some on your calendar so that your calendar isn't the white rabbit in the snowstorm.
Right, you're starting to put some trees in your white snowstorm.
Exactly right. And that really helps. And once you've done that, and as you add things to your life gradually, as you prototype and see what you like, those activities add some more things to your calendar.
They breed, do they not? They sort of breed on themselves, and they grow in and of themselves, starting small, and it sort of grows. It's sort of like maybe not quite as frequent as rabbits, but they will grow, and you will have more and more activities. And then you may find, you know, it's rituals. You know, I have morning rituals, and I will not ignore my morning rituals that are, you know, 2 to 2.5 hours long, but I do it every day, every day, every day, every day. And, you know, it's not in my calendar, but I know from 6 to 9:30, I cannot make an appointment until 10 o'clock in the morning unless it's an emergency.
Perfect. It's very grounding, right, Charlie? Very grounding.
Yes.
And interestingly, if things grow and your calendar gets too crowded, then you have the thing that you can do just the opposite of what Nike says. You can just undo it. When you've got lots of these little dishes, you can say, okay, I'll set this one aside for now.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Nike's antipodal opposite. So then you also talked something I really liked for especially retiring people, but I just see so many, like, you know, you taught your sons budgeting, or your son and your daughter budgeting. You talk about catching up and doing first things first. Tell me what you mean by catching up. And this falls into
okay,
sort of that second step, maybe.
And to your point about this being useful to more than just people who are retiring or just retired, you know, make sure that you understand your finances. Make sure that you know what's coming in and what's going out so that you can not be one of the people who runs up tons of credit card debt and then uses a huge chunk of their income just to pay interest. If you're married and have children, make sure that you've got a will and a durable power of attorney for health care. So if something happens to you, God forbid, people are okay. And if you've got a decent amount of assets, then get together a trust document. Don't wait until you're 70, because you never know when you're going to, you know, have the bear get you.
You know, and the trouble of not doing that, wills, you know, the leaving it up to the estate, the judges in estates, you know, they're never fairly distributed. They're never distributed the way that you would distribute it. And it is so worth the time and little bit of expense to do that. You know, trust and estate planning is very big in our life.
So that's, you know, that's some important stuff to make sure you're up to snuff on at any age, but certainly if you're at retirement age. And then, you know, catch up on other things. All too many of us have a two-car garage that hasn't seen a car in decades. And there's mountains of stuff in there that gets no use. And so do something good for somebody else, for goodness sakes. Give that to Goodwill. Give that to St. Vincent de Paul. Give that to some charitable organization where somebody will get to use those things instead of them filling your garage. And you'll feel a whole lightening of your load. And guess what? Then you'll be able to put your car away and you won't have to wash it as often. So it's a nice side benefit.
Yeah, and you know, I noticed it with myself, Andy, is that I just purchased, you know, I kept my computer for a while, but I just purchased a new computer, a new laptop and a new iPad, and I have the old iPad and the old computer sitting around, and I'm reading of these children, poverty children, that don't have computers and can't attend class online because they don't have computers. What are these computers doing sitting in my office? How am I possibly going to use older computers? I'm never going to go to this. I'm never going to go to this iPad or this MacBook. You know, they need to be given away. It's just, you know, it's a, and I'm doing a public service in doing so.
Yep, and I know that on the Apple products, they have a good thing that built in that lets you wipe your machine so it's ready to give away.
Right, I've done that. They're clean. They're perfectly clean.
PCs.
Yeah, they're perfectly clean. They're perfectly clean.
Yep.
You know, I want to spend some time on one that I don't know if this is point three, but something you mentioned, and I think it's worthy of a bit of discussion, and that is you talked about start doing something you love. Now, that makes all the sense in the world, except how many people, Andy, do not know what they love? They're not in touch with that. What do you suggest? What are means to discover what you love?
Yeah, it's, I'm going to use a difficult word here. I'm going to say it's tragic how many people I've spoken to in my 60-something peer group really don't know. I'm like, wow, I guess we've been busy these last few decades, didn't have room. But, you know, if you go back to your youth, there was something you loved when you were a kid. There was something you loved when you were a teen. There was something you loved when you were in college or your 20s. And that's a starting place. You know, maybe it's only listening to music like you used to. Well, you can get your, you know, you can go ahead and get on Spotify or Apple Music or whatever music thing you like and build up a music collection and enjoy that. If you really can't think of anything you love, poke around with your friends and see what they love. And ask if maybe they'll include you in something so you can try it. If that doesn't work, read a little bit. See what other people are doing in some magazines. And see if there's something you might want to give a try. And now we're back to Mine It for Learning. Wow, I like this. I think I'll do this a bunch more. Wow, I didn't like this. I don't want to do anything like that.
When I was 60 years old, I taught myself how to paint. Now, I have I cannot paint. I can barely do stick figures, but I have composition and color capabilities that I do understand how to compose and put colors together. And for 7 years, I was involved in abstract painting, and I would paint 4 to 7 hours a day, and it was totally enjoyable. But then, because of a number of circumstances, I realized I wasn't going to get any better at it, and I had to either devote a lot of time to getting better at it, or it was time to quit and start something new. And fortunately, I had the wherewithal to decide quitting was not a bad thing. This was a great activity that I loved for 7 years, but it was time to move on to something different. You're an advocate of quitting as well. Once you discover something, you talk about not being afraid of quitting. And quitting is such a negative word in our culture, and yet sometimes things need closure, do they not?
Well, they really do. And at least in this retirement age, it's one thing if you quit a job, right? And you've got a mortgage and expenses and a family and so on. That's a big deal. You better have something else lined up so you can take care of your responsibilities. If you've, saved well, earned well, saved well, and now you're at a time when money isn't your primary concern, now if you try something and it doesn't feel good, or it doesn't work for you, or you learned you didn't like it, you're really not quitting. You're just choosing.
What a great idea. You're not quitting, you're choosing. So what we do is, as we wrap up here, what we're doing is we are adding tapas, are we not? We're adding, let's just try different dishes that we would ordinarily order a main course. And I sort of solder in my main courses in restaurants. And now, as a matter of fact, tonight's my wife's birthday, and we're going to a tapas restaurant. And that's all they serve.
I love it.
And we will just experiment with a number of different dishes. And is that not what you're talking about in discovering something you love? It's sort of, I think you told me, add tapas and stir. Just keep trying something different, and something's going to come along that's going to strike a chord, and you will find, maybe not something for your entire life, but you will find something that's very beneficial for you for the next, who knows, year to 2 to 3 to 4 years.
Exactly. And in fact, one step further is my chapter called Fail Freely. And that's that if you try it and you turn out to have no talent for it, and it can be said by an observer that you failed miserably, who cares? There's no cost. And plus, unknown to the observer, you learn something. You mind it for learning. And now you choose to set it aside and try a different tapa. And really, it's been a long time in your life since you could take something on and fail miserably and it didn't matter. And it turned out instead to just be a learning experiment.
I love it. Andy Robin, I am so pleased with this opportunity to explore your experience and the wisdom that you have to offer. I'm in total love with the tapas idea. It is just, you know, I'm in the midst of at 71 years old, entering a career and entering something new that has been percolating for 19 months. I knew something was happening, but I didn't know what was happening. I just knew I had certain disciplines I had to follow in order to get clarity on what I'm to do, and the clarity is beginning to emerge, and I am so excited. I am so excited about the future of my life right now. And that's at 71. You know, I used to be at 71, you know, you're a couch potato, but I'm far from that. And there's both an experimental and luck factor, and then there is also a diligent effort that goes into it at the same time, and it's a beautiful combination. And I think your book, The Tapas Life, really shows people ideas of how they can pursue that. How do you prefer people get in touch with you, Andy?
If folks go to tapaslife.com,
okay,
TAPASLIFE.com, you know, you can see more about the book and things people have said about it, and some excerpts and stuff like that. And there's a link to Amazon if you want to buy the paperback or a Kindle version. And there's also a contact page there where you can send me an email message.
Perfect. Yeah, I encourage listeners to do that. Andy Robin, thank you so much. Thank you for your book. Thank you for your wisdom. And so nice to find other members of the choir.
Thanks again for the fun conversation, Charlie. And I hope you guys enjoy your tapas birthday dinner.
Yeah, I do too. Thank you so much. All right, I want to thank everyone for tuning in to The Next Chapter with Charlie. Please check out our website at thenextchapter.life. And until next, this is Charlie Hedges signing off. Bye for now.